You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Robert Storr,
the Dean of the Yale School of the Arts. Robert, thanks so much for being with
sure.
us. I think I'd like to jump into the role of the critic. I've interviewed the late Arthur Danto, Barry Schwabsky, a number of critics, mm-hmm. and they all have Dave Hickey. They all have a pretty varying idea of what it is that a critic does, and what's your perspective on that here and in this context, or in any context really.
I think there are many different genres of criticism, for starters, and there are different audiences for criticism. And I think the first choice a writer who wants to write about art, let's call him an art writer or her an art writer, has to do is decide for whom and about what they would like to write, because there's no one-size-fits-all definition of what a critic does. Arthur was basically a philosopher who wandered in criticism because his wife was an artist, because he was interested in the visual arts and so on. He was intermittently a very good critic and often really way off base because the undertow of philosophy and of the desire to make sweeping statements was just too great to resist. Dave Hickey is a very able essay writer who is actually not a very good art critic at all and has devolved from being an interesting spoiler in the context of the art world to being a Tea Partier, basically. He mobilizes resentment against arts, and he mobilizes people's sense that it's all a rigged game, and plays off on that to give himself a reputation as an outsider. But he's an outsider with a PhD in English literature. Mm-hmm. He is not a tough Texan. He's a kid from, Fort Worth. And he's created this persona, which is actually an artfully constructed persona, but he is not at all what he pretends to be and when he's a writer. Mm-hmm. And he loves to be, go after academics and curators and assume that they're all, sold out and so on and so forth. But he's the guy with a PhD, not me.
Right.
and he's the guy who has advised Steve Wynn, who's now known as a great Medici, not me, and not a lot of other people who write. And in the meantime, he's actually not very good about art. He wrote a whole long essay about Larry Pittman without mentioning that Larry is half Hispanic and gay, which is an awfully big thing to miss when you look at the work. Mm. So he's another type. Barry's a poet, and a successful poet, good poet. He's belongs to sort of belletristic type criticism, and he's very effective at it. Not least he's written nice things about me, so what can I say? But, as a painter. But there are all kinds of critics. There are the theoreticians, Al Foster and Benjamin Butler and so on. I think they have a lot of problems, as does Dave Hickey, with actual art history. They know almost none. They are technically art historians academically, but they know very little art history. They've done very little primary research. They don't really know history very well either, because they read theory about history, but they don't read history. So they will, write articles predicated on certain sweeping generalizations about the 1930s in Europe, and then apply them without any adjustments to circumstances which are not those. And they also will make major historical mistakes about the 1930s in Europe. So I admire who they admire. I admire Walter Benjamin. I admire all of the Frankfurt people and so on and so forth. But I don't think the American version of French theory or of Frankfurt School in contemporary art criticism is of much use to anybody.
Hmm. And other critics, that's good.
That's called being a critic of critics.
I like that. Well, that's part of what I think understanding all their different roles to a lot of people is helpful with. And there's someone like Jerry Saltz, Roberta Smith.
Jerry's appalling, just frankly. Mm. He's the class clown. He was somebody I've known a long time. I knew him since Chicago days. And he's turned into a travesty, even of a travesty. And the idea that he should be running around being the conscience of the art world and at the same time playing the game of the art TV show that he did, and that he should be championing women and then dissing the first African-American woman curator to do Site Santa Fe, all of these things are about Jerry, long and short. And about Roberta, it's all about Roberta, long and short. And it's too bad, because they are punchy writers. And so, again, they draw interest because of the contrariness, but they're no principle. They're not fighting long-term battles for anything, and never have.
And how does that figure in with the whole, with all these other schools of criticism? I mean, you know, Jerry, I feel the same way, has also achieved this popularity.
He's playing to the peanut gallery, right? He's playing to an audience that actually doesn't know about art, doesn't really like art. Roberta the same way. I mean, she's writing in the New York Times, and she is writing insider writing for outsiders. I mean, she's there. If you read her criticism carefully, and I have for a very long time, she's constantly playing intramural battles about the art world and who's in and who's out and who she has a grudge against and so on and so forth. But she's publishing it as if it was information that everybody needed to know, does know, etc., which it's not. If she would write about the art right in front of her, if she would suspend her own self-importance long enough to really give more attention to the complexities of being an artist, she would write better. And Jerry the same.
But that's not going to happen because that's part of how
they're...
Because
they're going to pay for it.
Yeah, and they're also... I suppose that's has something to do with where journalism about art is, visual literacy, artistic literacy.
The journalism about art now is at the lowest ebb it has ever been, right? I mean, there was a time in the 50s when you had Greenberg, who was an empire builder, but a very gifted one, Fairfield Porter, Donald Judd, 50s and 60s, Bob Morris. A lot of people were writing a lot of stuff that is still really worth reading, you know. And I can't imagine that much of this stuff anybody will read 10 years from now. Mostly you can't read it a week after it's published.
And why is that? What's happened? Is it kind of the dumbing down of journalism? I mean, I was talking to a reporter not long ago who was saying, you know, everything is about comments now. Comments. How many comments can you get in an article? And the way you get comments is by saying something inflammatory or...
That's right.
So has this affected the art world too and critics alike?
Totally. It's like critics have gotten confused about the issue of what their role is. I mean, they're there not just to admire or just to observe, but they're there to weigh and think and look better than the average person in order that the average person be tested and do it better themselves, right? So if you set a model of what it means to look hard at something, think a while about it before you open your mouth, and then articulate it carefully, you will have done your job as a critic, and you can have any opinion you want. There are many critics I read who I disagree with fundamentally, but I always learn from them. But this is about instant response. It's about the number of likes you get on your Facebook thing. I mean, who knows? It's all about the ego, popularity, presence of the critic. And frankly, none of these people that I've mentioned, like Robert and Jerry, are interesting enough to really merit being a presence in the world.
So is there a way out of that? I mean, what is the future of writing? It seems to be just, you know, kind of devolving into this kind of, I don't know, popularity sort of contest. But what's the hope for that? Is there
Charlie Finch was the pioneer of this kind of vanity criticism and spoiling criticism. And, you know, does anybody read Charlie Finch now? Does he even write? No. What's the future for it? Not much. I'm a craftsman. I may have many faults, and I'm sure I do, but I'm a craftsman. I work very hard at writing well, and I've worked very hard at looking before I write. And I do homework, and I listen to artists, and I do everything I think I need to do before I sit down and then deliver an opinion that I hope will be thought about, not agreed with. Mm. You know? And there's one of the people I greatly admire is Virgil Thompson, who was the composer and critic. And he wrote for the old Herald Tribune, and he wrote something that I think is sort of my motto. He says, never overestimate the information base of your reader and never underestimate their intelligence. Mm. And most of the people we're talking about do both, but backwards.
Right. And are there other critics that you can think of that you admire who are kind of walking that road? Or
There are a lot of people I read. I used to read Peter Sheldahl with much more interest than I do now because I think he's burned out. I like Christian Viveros-Fonet, who I think is actually trying hard to write a principled criticism. Marcia Schwarzenegger, I like reading. I really admire Holland Feller. I think he's doing a very good job. Mike Brenson, who tried to do the same thing at the Times and was basically driven out, I like very much. I mean, there are a lot of people I read and like.
Hmm.
Chris Knight out in Los Angeles.
And so talking about now the academic environment, you know, why does an artist need to go to school? What's the importance of that? And I know the somewhat obvious questions, and you can take this anywhere, but a school like Yale, the MFA program in particular, in one sense carries this kind of mythic weight in the art world.
Yeah, it does.
And then there's this sense of, I know plenty of artists that come from Yale that didn't move on to mythic careers, you know? So,
well, most artists don't. I mean, and getting an arts education is not, the importance of getting an arts education is not measured by the fame index, you know? To be able to sustain yourself making your work over a lifetime is an achievement in and of itself. It's very hard to do. To become a good teacher of art is very hard to do. To learn enough about your work from all angles to be able to do it properly is very important in and of itself. So the fame factor, which is the same thing as affecting the writing of some of the people we discussed, the fame factor is very distorting, right? Some people got fame very early. Jasper Johns got it very, very early, relatively. Frank Stella got it even earlier. Jasper has been famous for, since 1957. It's a long time. And to stay on top for that long is a very hard thing to do. Most people don't. Most people have a relatively short run. And many of those people have their short run early. And the ability to stay in the game, to make good work, to hold your head up, and so on and so forth, is, as I say, it's a real accomplishment. And I think, to go back to your initial question, one of the things is that in art school you meet a certain cohort of your contemporaries, and very often they become very important people for the rest of your life. And it's not like, you know, college alumni buddies in other fields. It is a group where the struggles and the difficulties that you face are shared in certain ways that makes those people often more reliable as friends later on.
So you're talking about peers, classmates at school.
Yeah. I think most art schools are distinguished, the most good art schools are distinguished by the dynamic amongst the students. The teaching is secondary. The schools that are run in a way that foster the greatest energy among the students, you know, which also means yielding to them and letting them do it themselves some of the time, are the great schools. And often they don't have great teachers, or sometimes they have one or two great teachers.
But that also assumes that they're going to get together, I mean, afterwards, which seems it's beyond the school, and may or may not happen. When I interviewed John Kern for the show, he told me he graduated, you know, painting work that nobody particularly liked, and he was painting houses, and he said, you know, it was at one point, 4 years out of school, thought, you know, what am I doing? You know, and just crying on the scaffolding, thinking I'm wasting my time, and did essentially what you're saying, but got back together, called up some friends from school, started meeting regularly, and saying, you know, how can we help each other out here? But that wasn't something that was even fostered by the school, really.
It's because you create a situation where these bonds can grow, right? No, of course it depends on the individuals, and John's story is actually a fairly common story. And I think that the people who go the course often find themselves in situations like that. I mean, you know, I once thought, and this was before I came to Yale, I just did it as an experiment, you know, to do what it is that students made when they were here before they made the work for which they're known. Nancy Graves was making kind of Braque-like paintings, you know, and Rax Jordaens, who's a realist, was making kind of like Al Hill-type paintings, and Chuck Close was making kind of all the sort of Klaus Ohlenberg paintings. And actually, once when I did my first dean's talk here, I put a drawing up on the screen, and it was a drawing of a kind of lumpy middle-aged woman, standard, you know, drawing exercise class kind of thing. And at one point, one of the female faculty members objected and said, "Why do you have this nude woman up on the screen for the whole thing?" I said, "Well, I'll explain in a minute." And at the end, I said, "Okay, well, this is drawn by Eva Hesse." So it was, first of all, it was the female gaze on a nude woman, not the male gaze. Secondly, it was a drawing that nobody would have pegged as an Eva Hesse drawing, but it allowed you to see the enormous leaps that she took while she was here. And she's one of Albert's favorite students. Now, she took those leaps while she was here, and that gave her the ability to leap altogether, so that when she left here with Tom Doyle, and when she went to Katwijk in Germany, she took another series of major leaps, so that when she came back, she had a very short life. You know, she died when she was 30, 31. She crammed more really serious art making into a very short years than anybody I know other than Felix Gonzalez Torres. You know? And I think it's the kind of sense of the seriousness of the vocation and the risk-taking that needs to be done that occurred here that made that possible.
That makes sense. And, of course, those are success stories. Then there's the stories you hear that I think Robert Gober touched on a few years ago when he gave a talk here, but was talking about, I mean, as he put it, just kind of blatantly, he said, you know, a lot of my assistants come from the MFA program, and as far as I'm concerned, it fucked them up. You know, they can't make work now. Now, this clearly isn't the case for everyone, but there is a phenomenon where people get out of MFAs, and I don't know whether it's not being able to withstand crits or whatever it is, but some students feel that they can't produce work after that.
I don't want to sound like a social Darwinist, but if they can't, then they're not made for this profession. People have got to have a kind of need to do it. And they have to have not self-confidence in the sense of knowing that they will succeed, but a fearlessness about the possibility of failure. And, Franz Kline once said that artists are different from other people because they have a higher tolerance for embarrassment. You know, people who come to programs like this and think only in terms of success and don't think about failure are really ducking the issues, right? How do you deal with failure? What do you do with failure? How do you retool failure to turn into something else? And how do you just, you know, withstand the emotional strain, you know? I've had a lot of failures in my life, and that's why I'm tough, and that's why I'm still at it. You know, I think a lot of kids now are kind of hothouse flowers. They come through very high-powered programs in secondary school and college, and then they arrive and they just think they're going to continue succeeding. Right? It's not like that. It's not like another profession where you can sort of get on the escalator and just go up.
So complex because of that. I mean, and I understand that also as an artist, writer, and, yeah. You know, but it's. But unlike any other profession, students are prepared for that. And, of course, it makes complete sense to me what you're saying. But still, is part of what they're learning here how to manage failure, how to retool failure, as you say, how to manage even the emotional stress of what that means to someone?
Okay. I mean, there was a kid who was here. He's not a kid. He's a man. Who was here a couple of years ago, who was an Asian man. He was gay. He came from the South. And he made work that was, I thought, quite interesting, but many people did not. And there was a very famous gay photographer who was in the room and who took him apart, really took him apart, and did so from the position of an older gay artist saying, this is not the way to deal with these issues. And he did it, I think, out of sincere regard for the guy, but it was really rough. And I cringed, you know, partly because, again, I kind of liked some of his work more than the other person did. But in any case, I saw the student a couple of days later, and I asked him, how are you doing? And he kind of had this wonderful, plucky attitude, right? He'd clearly been wounded. You know, anybody would have been wounded. But he had that ingredient. He had what it takes to bounce back. You know, what it is, hard to say. But you know who's got it and who doesn't. Some people do it by grinning and bearing it. Some people do it like by smiling through the disaster. I mean, he's more than the smiling through the disaster type. But there are people who just are not going to stop, and you can feel it and you know it, and they are the real ones who will become artists.
In conclusion, you've done an awful lot in the art world. You're an artist yourself, and so much publishing, and the Venice Biennale, mm-hmm. And of course, this is your second term as mm-hmm. as dean. What's next for you? Those seem like peaks in the art world for an academic, for an artist, for a critic. I can't imagine doing more, but what would be next?
I'm going to do what I started out to do, which was to make my own paintings. Most of the jobs that I've had that I did not compete for, that I did not go for, there were things that people asked me to do, were jobs I did because I need to make a living and support my family. So, honest to God, you know, and so now that I'm kind of at the age where I have enough money tucked away and so on and so forth, and I sort of don't have much else to do professionally, I'm just going to make my painting and see. I'm going to go from being a quite well-known curator and critic to being a totally unknown painter, and I'm going to really like it a lot. And
that's exciting. So let's just hear a little bit of what's happening in your painting studio now. I mean, you've been consistently painting, haven't you? You're doing more now, or has it been on and off?
I've painted always. I've painted very little for recent years. I've done some printmaking. I've never, ever said I was not an artist or I'd stop being an artist, because I know the minute you turn the switch off that way, you're done. Inside, you're done. So I've always given myself projects to do and so on, and I Yeah, I was in 91. I went to Yaddo to, thanks to Mike Sundell and Nina Sundell, who were the people who ran it. And I spent half the day writing a Robert Ryman catalog and half the day making drawings. And I've been giving those drawings to benefit auctions ever since. You know, there's not a lot of work of that type, but there's enough so that I can look at it and say, yeah, this guy's got something going for him. And so now I'm just going to go in the studio and make lots more. We'll see.
Drawings as
well. Well, those were drawings, but I'm a painter, basically.
And what were the drawings that
you know? Abstract geometric paintings on paper with... Once upon a time, I was a realist painter, an observational, you know, kind of new realist type. I was a big admirer, and I'm now still a very good friend of Philip Perlstein, friend of Alex Katz, admirer of Katz and all that. So that was my neighborhood for a while. But I decided I just didn't want to do that much describing, so I was much more interested in the spaces in the paintings than I was in the things that occupied them, so I shifted over. We'll see. Who knows? Maybe I'll come out wild and woolly and do something else.
I look forward to that.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.